Who's the breath?
Okay, let's do it.
Showtime.
Yeah. Good morning, everybody. I'm Elizabeth Robinson, and I actually helped to run a college and community station. It's a hybrid. We're going to be 50 years old this coming year. KCSB is the name of the station, and I'll tell you something very small about that in a minute. But before we actually begin with content, I'd just like to suggest a couple of things, give you a little idea about how we're going to go about this morning. Each of our panelists will have 2 or 3 minutes, up to 5 minutes. Some of them say, I only need a little bit, so we'll see about that. We're all talkers. We're all radio people. So everyone will have a chance to begin by making their own statement, and then I'd like to give the panelists an opportunity to respond to one another briefly, and then we're going to try and have most of the time, or at least half the time, to have an interaction with all of you. So everybody knows what the name of the panel is, I think, today. We are here about saving college radio. And I would have to say, first of all, that it's really about saving community media generally. Certainly college radio is under a particular form of attack, but it's certainly not the only one, as we all know. And the one thing I did want to say about KCSB is that we're quite independent in terms of financing and student control, and we have community input and all of those things, and we do things for our university, et cetera. The one thing that we do not control, and this is where many of us are vulnerable, I think, is our license. The regents of the University of California hold our license and the licenses of all of the other University of California radio stations. So even if KCSB by itself is not a huge financial asset, I mean, by all of our standards, it's probably fairly huge, but in terms of a university budget, it's pretty small. If you aggregate all of our licenses together, then it's a chunk of change. And for those of you who are not from California, if you don't know that California is in a financial crisis, not because there's no money, but because the money is not distributed terribly well, it's conceivable that a University of California, which has been cutting its budgets annually, could end up deciding to sell our licenses. And they, at the end of the day, control it. So today what we want to do is talk about some of the threats to us, but more importantly, we want to talk about how to go forward and how we can protect ourselves and do some solidarity with one another, I'm sure, as well. And we don't want to just focus on any one particular case, though we're very happy to have a number of KUSF folks in the audience. And, you know, to really try to think our way through some of this and some of the things that we might do in future to protect ourselves and protect other licenses, et cetera, and other communities more than the licenses. Got a lot of lawyers in the room today, so I'm sort of thinking of the legal stuff. So that's basically it for me, except when we get to the Q&A part or the comments and questions, for those of you who are always the first one in the rooms to ask the question, restrain yourselves a little bit and see who else might come to the fore. And basically, let's try and make space for everybody that wants to speak to speak. With that, we're going to begin this morning with Ken Friedman, and we'll be going through each of our panelists, and they'll be talking about their own particular focus before we continue. Okay? Ken, thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name's Ken Friedman. I'm general manager and program director of WFMU. We're an independent freeform station located in Jersey City, New Jersey. And my introduction to this topic started when I was hired by Uppsala College to manage WFMU in 1985, and it was pretty clear that the college was slowly going bankrupt. And as their slide into bankruptcy accelerated, we set up actually two not-for-profit groups, and we ultimately were able to buy our own license in 1994. And we were the only asset saved from the bankruptcy block, from the auction block, and we were left as the only occupied building on a 40-acre college campus. And during the time that we became independent, I was also working with a friend of mine, the general manager of WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, Harry Minot, because his station was going through a very, very similar situation. Our two stations were going through essentially takeovers, where the universities were looking to sell the license to religious organizations. So Harry and I helped one another. So I was also involved in the ultimate independence of WPKN from the University of Bridgeport. Both of those things happened in the early 1990s. Since that time, I think, because I'm not even aware whether those are the only two such cases of student slash community stations breaking off of their parent institution and becoming independent, but they're the two that most people know about. So since that time, in the decades that have passed, I've been communicating with student slash community stations. Every time a threat like this arises, I think I get a phone call or an email. And I've passed on the paperwork that we used. We employed a whole bunch of different techniques, right of first refusal, ultimately an LMA. There was also an option to buy in order to become independent. And the technique that both WPKN and WFMU used was a strategy that we came to call sell it and keep it, convincing the parent institution to sell the license. But contractually, the buyer, us, would be obliged to continue to give them all the services that they had even enjoyed. And in fact, we even went so far as to improve the services that they had enjoyed. Because it's putting it mildly to say that most colleges and universities that own radio stations don't feel that they're getting enough for their investment. Before passing it on, I just want to say that I don't think that the situation that's been happening in the last year or two is an aberration, and I don't think it's going to go away. I think it's only going to accelerate. I think that student radio stations have to really take active active approaches to trying to protect themselves and the service that they've been providing to their community. They can't expect anybody else to do it for them. I've handed out a list of things that I think student stations should keep in mind and perhaps do to try to preserve their license. But I also think that a possible solution to, as much as there may be a solution to this situation of student stations being sold off by their parent institutions, I think one possible solution is the adoption model of getting other radio stations who care about community radio and care about the service that student and community radio have been providing to sort of take these other stations under their wing. So WFMU has sort of taken KUSF under its wing. I've also been helping my alma mater station, WCBN, in Ann Arbor, try to set up a not-for-profit group so that they can be prepared. But I'd like to see more stations, more healthy, mature community and public radio stations taking one or two student stations under their wing and trying to help them protect it, because to whatever degree this situation can be stopped or slowed down, I think that's the way to do it.
Okay, thank you. Dwayne?
Oh, okay.
I think.
Yeah. I didn't write down the order we're doing this in. I'm Dwayne Bradley, General Manager at KPFT, the Pacifica Radio in Houston. I think I'm the one that's not from a college station up here. I wore my college shirt, which is where I started a long time ago. I've been the general manager there for almost 10 years now, and was as shocked as the rest of the community when at the end of last summer session, Rice announced, well, Rice didn't even announce it. It was leaked to the newspapers in Houston that this transaction had happened, that the University of Houston was buying out the Rice K-True signal, and that 91.7 was going to morph into an all-classical branch of the University of Houston. So we wrote an open letter. The program director and I wrote an open letter to Rice, a letter of solidarity, offering our services, whatever those could be, in terms of using KPFT as a platform for rallying support. We had a We don't have a lot of room at the station, but we have used PTFP funds to build what we're calling our HD2 studio. We made an offer to the K-True staff that anyone that should the inevitable happen, we would welcome them coming in and programming through our HD2 studio and using KPFT. And that was really about, and we went to some rallies and we spoke on behalf of them and we wrote letters to the paper and things like that. But we were approached actually by the general manager of Rice, and I went to lunch with him. And he had actually come up with this idea of, why not lease your HD channel to us? The university has offered to keep me and the engineer on staff for at least the next 2 years. They've offered to provide all the bandwidth the students would need to stay on campus, pay all of the utilities, keep the studios, not have to leave the campus, and basically pipe K-True through KPFT and transmit it using our HD2. So I got in touch, fortunately, our executive director, Arlene Engelhart, who had just come to Pacifica from WMNF in Tampa, and they had crafted a similar arrangement with the University of South Florida. And so we used the arrangement that they had worked out as a template, and it took a number of months and a lot of back and forth, and, you know, and we're dealing with university bureaucracy. So it took longer than we would have liked, but we were able to work out an arrangement that essentially leases this channel to Rice. They had to agree to some things that a lot of students didn't want to, like they had to sign off on documentation. We require all of our programmers to sign, and Rice has always been a little bit more loosey-goosey about that. There was a little pushback, but in the end, we reached this agreement, and so we were able to, in a limited sense, save, you know, K-True. We promoted the real Save K-True movement in the hopes that some of their challenges, their petitions to deny, would prove to be successful. When they failed and were rejected, we then went through and, you know, completed this arrangement. So that was kind of, in a nutshell, how the whole thing went in Houston. And I don't know how well that serves as a model or not for anyone else here, but, you know, we're trying to find, in a certain sense, the silver lining in a real cloud. And we also, because we were both going through this, both Rice and KPFT, hit Ibiquity up for as much free product as possible and promotional, you know, and PR assistance to try and get the mass media to write stories about it and raise a little bit more consciousness about what was happening with this whole transaction.
Thanks, Dorothy. Yeah, it's wonderful to see you all. I'm really looking forward to your questions because I think there's probably as much expertise out there as there is here. My name is Dorothy Kidd. I teach media studies at the University of San Francisco. Before that, I guess I've been a community media person since I was very young, and I worked in community radio for 20 years, and I now document community media efforts around the world of community organizations and social movements for social justice and democratizing the media. So when the station was, when it was announced on January 18th, I had no idea that KUSF or that USF was considering selling the station. And I found myself working with an incredible group of volunteers since then to make sure that that transfer does not go through. It has not yet been finalized, and I want to start off by saying that. KUSF has not been sold. The deal has not yet been ratified by the Federal Communications Commission. The second thing I want to say is before we talk about saving college radio, I think it's important to repeat, and I think everybody in this room knows this, but sometimes we're too humble, that community and college stations have saved radio. I think that's why we're here. Community and college stations have shown the continuing value of the airwaves, and I think that's why commercial stations now want to buy them, because they are valuable. Susan Harmon told us at the South by Southwest conference that they were actually beachfront property. I don't think of them that way. I think of them as public resources. They're public airwaves. They generate democracy. They nurture community groups in doing what the commercial media has abdicated, the responsibility to us as citizens, which is to provide quality information, a platform for dialogue and discourse, not only of individual community groups and individual programs, but to provide a bridge so that all of us are better informed about all of the different groups in our communities. They particularly serve marginalized groups or groups that have been historically misrepresented by not only the commercial media, but I'm a big fan of NPR, but by public service media as well. KUSF did that, and Miranda Morris, who works there, has handed out a flyer, and it'll give you more details. KUSF did an exemplary job of providing a democratic public sphere. This is a multicultural city that we live in. KUSF provided programming in 12 different languages. It's a multi-music, multicultural, this is a cultural hotspot of the world. We all know that, right? That's why people come to San Francisco, including me. If you haven't noticed, I have a Canadian accent. And KUSF not only provided programming in 12 different languages, it provided programming for music programmers in all of the different genres of music. So new music from rock to hip-hop to new classical music and all of the different genres of classical music. And so I think it's important to start out by talking about how college radio has saved radio. The third thing, I guess, that sometimes it doesn't get said is KUSF and a lot of college community radio was really a bulletin board for local businesses and organizations. And I want to tell you as a teacher that there hasn't been a week gone by where my students haven't said to me, you know, every time I go out into the community and I put on my KUSF T-shirt, somebody, whether it's a taxi driver who gave one of my students a free ride because she had a KUSF T-shirt on, or the local venues, or the, I call them the apps guys, you know, we used to call them Silicon Valley, but now they're kind of into the apps generations. They all listened to and benefited by KUSF. So, in the abdication of responsibility from commercial radio, I think that's why most of us got into community radio. That's certainly why I did. So I know we only have a couple more minutes. So now we have a crisis. The left-hand side of the dial is still valuable. You know, when I first started teaching 20 years ago, they said radio was ready to go. Well, it doesn't seem to have gone. And one of the reasons why is that college radio has not only saved radio, it's also saved the music industry. When it was crashing, because it took the strip mall approach to radio, broadcasting to such narrow niches of people with such boring, homogeneous content that all of the generations of college students that I've taught left, abandoned it. Where did they go? They went to college radio, and they remade the music industry in this country. And because of the value of the music industry in this country, internationally, has waves internationally. KUSF has a lot of listeners in Japan. So what's the crisis? The crisis is that this valuable beachfront property is being seized upon. What are some of the solutions? Well, you know, my colleagues here, and especially Ken, he's got a whole little file of what you should do if you're on a university campus. You can read that afterwards. The other solution is I think that we need to have a really serious talk with our friends who are trying to help out, and I appreciate it, to try and make sure that those frequencies are not sold to the right-hand side of the dial. I'm all for that. But I think that we have a different model. It's not the NPR model. It's not the strip model. It's a community model. It's what in most jurisdictions around the world, Canada, Australia, or whatever, is the third level of broadcasting, community media. It's not public service media. It's community media. It has values that finally the FCC has recognized of localism and diversity. And that's not only worth saving, I think it's one of the only things that can save the music industry and democracy for us. So I really have some serious questions about the mission of Public Radio Capital and classical public radio. I don't think it's the model where we should go. I think we should go, and I want to say this publicly, for mixed media. I absolutely support public service media. But I think we need to also recognize and support the community college sector. And finally, I know this will come up in the question period, but people always ask, what can we do? Well, you can support our petition to deny the transfer of the sale, writing to the FCC. You can also, and I think this is extremely important, ask the FCC to initiate a public hearing about this crisis of college radio, because we got into this partly, or I got into this partly, because it's not just a local problem, it's a national problem. And third, you can ask your questions and give us some more suggestions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dorothy. Now, Mark Hand.
Hi, everybody. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I should have followed your lead. And my original start in radio goes back to college radio, also at KZSE in Santa Cruz, and started there, and then doing programs on KUSP in Santa Cruz. So I think that theme of the importance and value of college radio and community radio and public radio in general is really what fostered starting Public Radio Capital, and it really came from. Actually, one of the first projects that I did was working with Ken on helping to value WFMU when he was going through the process of looking at buying the station. And that was the first time that we really pulled together sort of all the history of non-commercial sales to sort of look what was going on in the non-commercial market. And back then, it was really almost all stations being sold to religious broadcasters. And then a couple years later in 1996, and again, really what helped start sort of this whole idea of what do we do to protect the assets, sort of broadly defined assets within the public radio system, the community radio system, was the sale of WDCU in Washington, D.C. And that was a station that was owned by the University of the District of Columbia, and it was running into financial trouble, and they decided to sell the station, and that was in 1996. And when they first put the station on the market, they asked $5 million for it, and it ended up selling for $13 million to a large non-commercial religious broadcaster who, before they closed on it, actually ended up selling it for a profit to C-SPAN. So at that time, really, the whole public broadcasting system realized that 60% of the stations that are funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting are licensed to colleges and universities and school boards and institutions. And in addition to that, there's another 800 or so stations that are non-commercial stations that are like the stations that we've been talking about that are not CPB qualified, but that are licensed to colleges and universities and school boards and in some cases cities and counties. So the starting in 1996, really what changed was that dual risk of institutions realizing that there was a value to licenses. I think before then, there was just a sense of, in the non-commercial part of the dial, that's different in the commercial part, and there's not a value to them. And so there really weren't sales of stations before then. There were transfers or, you know, things like what Ken was doing, really transfers to, colleges that just decided for a variety of reasons they couldn't operate the stations anymore. So that really is the impetus for starting Public Radio Capital, and it continues to be really the biggest risk facing sort of community radio and the reserve part of the band in general. And, I think the theme and really the importance of having discussions like this is that what happens, and it certainly happened with WDCU, is, as you said, that the colleges own the licenses. And once they decide to sell, Typically, they're doing that because they want to make as much money as possible from the sale of the station. And unfortunately, that means that they've decided also that they don't care whether they sell it to a community group or a public broadcaster or a religious broadcaster. And, you know, because that's what really optimizes the price on a station is being able to sell it to the highest possible bidder. Once that process starts, then it becomes a very defined process that most often excludes either a group associated with the station buying the station, or it generally excludes it going through a more public process. And it doesn't mean that that always happens. Like Vanderbilt now is going through more of a, they've decided they don't want to continue operating their station. They're going through a little bit more of a public process with that. But typically it isn't. So I think that, that because this is such a significant risk, and I guess the, you know, probably the theme that we have is the risk is that if we weren't doing the work that we were doing, if PRC didn't exist, almost all these stations would be sold to religious broadcasters. And it doesn't take away the impetus for institutions deciding to sell their stations, because they still will. And so I think the key thing is that it really does take a, you know, from Ken, what you've talked about, but it takes a really proactive discussion with all licenses, all licensees and stations that are at colleges or universities or school boards, because really the idea is, and what I hope we can really focus on and come out of this discussion, is that, again, once they've decided to sell the station, it becomes a different process. So I think the key thing is how to engage in these kind of conversations with a licensee and look at either how much more closely to integrate it with the college, with journalism departments or film departments or whoever, so that the college feels like it is a valuable asset, or again, be preemptive so that they somebody in the college doesn't say, this is worth a lot of money, we need money right now, we want to sell it. So really trying to have conversations with a licensee before it gets to that point, and doing it in a way that because it is such a significant risk, that we can all help each other in having those proactive conversations rather than having to pick up the conversation sort of after the fact when they've made a decision about it. So I look forward to being able to talk to people more about it and certainly answer any questions there are.
Thank you, Mark. Finally, John Murphy, you have the advantage of having his logo behind him.
Yes, no shameless flaming here. My contribution today will be a cautionary tale. Our radio station is at the University of Connecticut, and we have the fortunate history of going back to 1915. Some of the people up there, Storrs began as an agricultural college, and farming is a lot to do with the spirit behind this radio station in terms of how we're treating the environment around us. The university helped the station grow from a 10 water into 4,400 watts today. The tower is about 1,000 feet above sea level, and 10 years ago we got a power increase approved that gave us a much larger reach. And for 9 of the last 10 years, we've won an award in our region from a major local paper as the best college station. And I say that not to flame, but to let you know that no matter what level of success you may achieve, you can always do better, and there will always be people that will remind you that you can do better. This past year was very difficult for us. We went through a very great challenge within our school, asking us to do more for the university community locally. We had worked for so long to reach the outer community off campus with such measurable success. We forgot where we came from in a way, and we didn't do enough in our backyard, and people reminded us of that. And there was a challenge to that. There was some resistance. It was very stressful for the station. But we had to ultimately embrace the message, even though we disagreed with the messenger, because it was about doing a better job. And that's really what it's all about anyway. So the fact that we won this award is wonderful for us, but now we're going through a change. And one thing that we're going to experiment with is using the new digital technologies to differentiate our services and to rebrand them and make them more understandable for audiences in the community that have known us for decades, and audiences on campus that don't listen to us yet or don't know about us, and to use the web to let the university reach out to the world, because every school across the country is struggling to survive and to reach out, and we want to use these new technologies to serve our school that's been so supportive and generous for the station for so many years, so that we don't want to let one bad year of argument ruin a history of progress and block the future. So we're trying to put a whole positive spin on this in a genuine way. That's why I have this image up there. We've recently added Al Jazeera News with no opposition. People were asking us ahead of time, when are you going to air it? We put it on the air about a month ago. It's on the air during drive time for an hour every day. There's been no reaction at all. It's just more information. And the hype and the fear and the paranoia ended up being just a bag of hot air. So I just wanted to share that opener for you. But it really is a cautionary tale. So I want to get out of this and do a very short PowerPoint. I want to watch the clock the best I can. But I want to thank my wife, Rita, and Phil, because they took my PowerPoint that was just some pretty boring text, and they added some things last night to add a little humor to this and a little history to kind of make this easier in the eye and more worth your time. So the theme is we really have to save college radio from itself. College radio can be very inbred, very local, very focused on the here and now, and not so worried about the future. And that's one of its liabilities, is that unless it has people in its institution looking out for its future, it becomes very vulnerable. And some of the stories that we're hearing about are from stations, I think, that were taken advantage of because of their vulnerability. So we're going to go through this very quickly and watch the clock. College radio for me began in 1940 at Brown University when two students named George Abraham and Dave Borse helped to invent some of the technology called carrier current radio, running the wires. It was called the gas pipe networks. There were about 20 stations as founding members. WHUS happened to be a founding member in 1940. They've got hundreds of stations across the country, and they're focused really on the nuts and bolts of daily operations. And the association is the Intercollegiate Broadcasting System, IBS. If you do a Google on IBS, you're going to get irritable bowel syndrome. So make it IBS radio, and you might find out what they're all about. But the idea is that college radio, for us, can be a farm for the future. It can be a monastery to preserve and protect things. It can be an asylum if people abuse what they have in their hands and only think about themselves. So we're trying to deal with all those situations. But to me, college radio are the blue highways on the national telecommunications map. These are the places you find out about that are incredible, you never knew about. And these are the places where local people that will never have access to the interstates can share their beauty and love locally where people live every day. And I think that's one of the great things college radio has always had. Even when it's good, bad, and ugly, you know it's real. And it's always been a function of the intentions and the creativity and the resources that were given to the people behind the microphones. Some institutions support them more than others. Is college radio an asset? Is it something that a school that's desperate can sell off? As we've heard, this may become even more so because the environment is getting stressful for colleges. Is it a resource for people to use to kind of accomplish their missions and do a better job? Or is it a liability? Is it a matter of risk and exposure? Clock is running. We talked about that, the internal mission. When you have the stress, people within the university will have conflicts over their mission and purpose. And this is going to become increasingly exacerbated. So to me, where I want to go is to talk about these recent examples that you have heard about. The tragedy in all of this is not even what's happening, but how it's being done. To me, as a manager at a college station, it is shameful, disrespectful, and arrogant how the leaders of these institutions have treated the students that they're supposed to be there to serve. They make their decisions when they're away in the summertime. They do it during winter breaks. Students don't even participate in the arguments openly. I can say whatever hassles we're having with our school, they were in the open. We were able to debate and argue openly. When a school administrator treats a student with less respect than a dog, to me, they betray their institution. And if any administrator watches this video and you're thinking about doing this to your students, I say take a second look at what you're doing. Look in the mirror. These students that you're serving deserve better. You should be open and own the power that you have and be held accountable for using it. So, where do we go from here very briefly? I'm already over time. I know, indeed. What stations need to do is what some people have said here before. You need to have dialogues within your school now to realize what you have in your hands, to rebuild the relationships, so your school, however desperate it becomes, will always look to you as a resource to help them as well. The more you become conscious of your relationship and protect it, it's one of the best ways to avoid a nasty situation before it even evolves. We've talked about that already. I'm not going to take the time on that. I have two proposals. Where can we go from this meeting? Or for any student at a station watching this video, there are a couple of things to do. I've talked to many people at this conference about informally with NFCB forming a committee of managers to establish an action network and a linkage for conference calls, dialogue, sharing documentation, sharing defense and ideas, but we need to talk to each other now, and this is not a matter of money or funding. I truly hope NFCB will support this in some way with their structure to help the managers in our group talk to each other and to include more stations as a cooperative effort. I think there's a really good way to do this. It's not going to be that much work if people realize you compare it to the work that's done when you try to save a station. The last project is Artists for Media Diversity. I did a presentation here last year with Barbara Koyman, a Grammy-winning artist in Austin, Texas. This model has been developed as a way for local stations to deal with sustainability. And I think one of the best ways for a college station or a university is to grow its local cooperative culture economy, to begin to become more sustainable and more secure so that you're more protectable, that you're more able to do what you want to do. So there's no time for this. This is not a sales pitch. But if you go to a4md.org, you'll find out lots of information about this model, which is still being developed. We're looking for some funding and some beta tests in New England this summer. We have 154 stations that are in NFCB and Pacifica that can become partners in this effort in order to create a dialogue to find another way to grow local commerce. And I think that's one of the great projects that can help save what I heard from KUSF is the sacred relationship between radio and music that's been really compromised by money. If we take it back and work at it locally with our commerce partners to serve artists and the public more than ourselves, we've untapped a huge amount of energy for the future. So a4md.org is the site. It's all there for you to check it out. And I thank you very much for being here, for caring to be here today. And I say to everybody struggling now, just keep the faith. Thank you.
Thank you for letting me have a couple minutes over time.
Well, you used everybody else's that had been under time, so it's okay. We're all right. I just would like to go back to the panel in a minute, but I'd like to ask them to consider two or three things from things that I heard. And one, while I applaud the notion of community stations supporting college stations and helping to protect them, I think there's that other part about how we protect ourselves is really important to think about. But in terms of protection, I also would ask in terms of solutions, whether the solution does something that is not in either the commercial or the public radio model, which is to provide communication rights, not just information. So two-way platforms allowing access, you know, for students or for other members of the community, whether it protects localism and whether they protect a notion of democratic principles. And I say that and in part to say that for me and the crisis at college radio stations is a part of a much bigger crisis. It's a crisis in education, which is devalued, and it's a crisis in all sorts of social institutions that we are devaluing as a society. So how do we protect those things in the course of protecting college licenses and college stations? So I don't know if anybody would like to has pressing things they want to address to other panel members as well, but that's kind of where I would like to direct it a little bit. Ken?
Yeah, I'd like to address Mark and Public Radio Capital, because this since this situation has arisen, I've been struggling to understand the structure of the transactions, such as KTRU and KUSF and WDUQ. And I think I finally, after many, many hours of study and asking questions and Googling, I think I've finally figured out the structure. And I understand Public Radio Capital's mission of trying to keep public radio frequencies in the hands of public broadcasters as opposed to right-wing religious broadcasters. But now that I finally understand the structure that you've employed using not-for-profit LLCs, I think the thing, and I think this is why so many people are uncomfortable about it, and I want you to respond to it, is that you're a broker, but you're also, in a sense, the buyer. You're the managing director of CPRN, so that if KUSF is sold, if the sale is approved by the FCC, then you've also, in a way, bought the station. You're the managing director of this not-for-profit LLC that is the presumed buyer. Mm-hmm. How can you be acting in the public interest and then also be acting as a buyer?
That's a...
Mark, just quickly, so people know, I'm keeping a list, a stack of speakers, and I know Dorothy will come in after that, but please respond to...
Okay, sure. There are, I guess, multiple issues there, and it is sort of hard to understand the structures, because I think oftentimes the work that we're doing is almost reacting to really essentially a different situation in each different circumstance. But I think that the key theme when we talked about it a couple of days ago is, again, that idea of what happens once an institution decides to sell the station. So sometimes, like in the case of KXOT in Seattle or in Tacoma, Bates Technical College decided to sell that station, and that was the largest market in the country without a religious broadcaster. So in that case, and also all the existing licensees there were colleges and universities and school boards, and we knew that they didn't have the capacity to sort of move quickly enough to do something before Bates just put a for sale sign out and put it on the market. So in that case, we stepped in to buy the station and then turned around and originally did an operating agreement with KEXP in Seattle. So the idea was to hold the license, find a local operator so that again, it wouldn't be sold to a religious broadcaster. In other circumstances, and again, I think the key dividing point is once somebody decides to sell a station, they've set a process for doing that. And whether it's University of San Francisco or Rice or Portland Public Schools or, you know, a lot of the other projects that we've worked on. So, and typically we first find out about it when we're contacted by a broker that they've hired to do that. And so in the case of most of these situations, our task at that point really is to say, okay, what can we do to find a public buyer for this? And unfortunately, most often it isn't a public process. And, you know, I think your point of is an overall goal of really trying to find a way to make these kind of things more of a public process and a public discussion, again, before the college or the university decides to sell the station. And thirdly, I mean, one of the differences in terms of CPRN and sort of those dual roles is, and I guess it's a theme that certainly impacts the discussion here, is I think a big part of the problem is that most stations and most of these things take place in isolation, that the stations aren't working together locally, they're not working together regionally, and they're not working together nationally. And I guess one of the things that we're trying to do more of is to say, let's start connecting, I guess, some of that fabric between stations and play a more active role in doing that and assuming sort of a more active national entity role in playing a partner in stations. So, you know, I mean, I think in this case, you know, obviously it's the dual issue of you know, USF deciding to sell their station, and the key thing there would be ideally going in before that happens and preventing it. And, you know, we could play a partner role in the same way that we did if we could have done that before they decided to sell it rather than after. But then after the sale, it's also doing the same thing of saying, these aren't, in the media world especially, a lot of what we're dealing with are national entities that are doing this all over the country. And so how do we combine resources so that we're, I mean, some of the same things that you're doing informally, how do we do that to connect people and connect projects and stations and everything else together so that we're more effective in being able to preserve those local assets.
Dorothy?
Yeah, it's a little difficult talking. Well, okay, let me put it this way. You know, I think, Mark, we could have a really good win-win solution here. Let's say that, first off, that the University of San Francisco didn't recognize the value. And I'll be the first one to say you don't know what you've lost until it's gone, right? Joni Mitchell, great song. And it's been going through my head for the last 3 months. I didn't know what we had. Nobody knew, and the university certainly didn't know. So we'll say, okay, rash decision. The University of San Francisco has already changed one major decision it made at the same time, which was to also curtail another program, which was community-oriented, Upward Bound. They've already recognized the mistake because of community response. It would be absolutely wonderful if you would use your good offices to go to my provo and say, you know what, Provo Turpin, this is an incredible resource. We could help you in making it better. We could help you in making the best community radio station in San Francisco. We could support the other NPR, two NPR stations, and the Pacifica station, which are wonderful, and we could provide something that was unique for San Francisco. It would not only do that for the community, it would do it for the students, it would provide an entree for the students into the music industry and to digital industries as well as community service. I make that argument, but you're a lot more influential than I am with my provo, I hate to say, because you're not only a broker, you're also part owner of the new station. So what I'll say to you is that I'm glad that you've stepped in some situations, but this situation is not a good situation. The new station, KDFC, is not providing local content. It's not providing content in terms of classical music that's going beyond any kind of genre range or any kind of diversity. It's controlled by a chain. And secondly, and this is the other monkey in the room, not a giant in the room, the deal has led to Entercom, which is a pretty boring rock chain, getting a fantastic license in San Francisco. So even though you've stepped in to help us, sometimes people save the wrong things. Sometimes good intentions does not lead to, the grammar's wrong, but you know what I'm saying, right? Okay, so let me say to you, you know, it would be great if you would help us say, you know what, there's been some problems with this. There's operating problems right now as we speak, and it's not too late to talk to the University of San Francisco and say, let's produce the best community radio station that San Francisco could do.
Now you have to say.
Sorry, I'll say it later. I'm sure everybody else has more to say.
Does anyone else on the panel want to respond to any of this before we go to the floor? Everybody's good? Okay.
I just have one response to something Mark said, which is I understand the Tacoma situation where there was not a buyer for a non-commercial station, so PRC stepped in and bought it itself. And then tried to find a non-commercial or public operator. But that's very different from what's happening at KUSF. You had a buyer, and yet you now would be the managing director on behalf of the buyer, and PRC gets a piece of the asset. You actually get 10% or something of the asset. You can respond if you want to, but I'm just trying to make a point, not really ask a question, is I don't see how you can continue going down the line in this structure and be an unbiased broker when you're getting a piece of the action and you're actually like kind of buying stations on behalf of PRC. It seems like there's a conflict, a serious conflict of interest developing.
I guess. I guess it's still, I mean, the important distinction there is that we didn't encourage or ask USF to sell the station. And I think that's the biggest difference. And again, it's the frustration that once they decide to sell it, they do create a box that it's in, and you can't really change the constraints of that.
The problem is, Mark, that the president of USF has a totally different mind on that too, right?
Yeah.
So publicly, you know that in January 18th, he said
that the deal came across my desk. I was not wanting to sell it. And he repeated that, what, four or five times? So, anyways,
I can say from our experience that we were contacted by a broker that they had hired to sell the station.
Well, it's not a done deal yet.
All right, I've got a couple people who want to speak, and I want to throw in one more comment just quickly for also people to respond to, because I know we're Ustreaming or something, and people may not know some of the backstory. And it's what we're trying not to do is just talk about KUSF, but to talk about how we go forward. So just to keep those things in mind. And I appreciate Dorothy coming at it from a possible strategy for unknotting this particular knot. But let's also continue to think about it in, you know, what we do now. With that, I want to say Tracy and Jennifer and I, if there are other people who want to speak, show me your hands, Todd. Okay. Gotcha.
Tracy, then Jennifer, then Todd, and then Mary, and then Jim.
Let's see if we can take two or three comments and then get people to respond. Is that all right? Two or three questions and or comments.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll get some responses.
Oh, hi, everyone. This is kind of a compound question. It kind of has two halves. The first is sort of a question about sort of the larger place that we're heading. I did a little bit of research, looked at some old documents about 10 years ago, things like the Station Research Group and some of the entities that, you know, helped to bring public radio capital into business in order to specifically address some concerns in the public radio, think tank, maybe, is the right word? So looking over some of that stuff, what I saw was some very specific language about growth strategies for public service radio to continue through the next century. There was some very specific language there about basically getting one's hands on all of the other licenses in the non-commercial spectrum. My thought when I come to something like an NFCB that is a union of both what we call community broadcasters and public service broadcasters is that at least on the surface there has been some sense of kumbaya or solidarity or we are all operating the airwaves in the public interest in one way or the other, some of us with larger amounts of CPP funding than others. So the question that I have, and there's a second part to this, is what does it mean if, in fact, the primary growth strategy for public media is the evisceration of community media or any and all licenses that are not already in the hands of public media? What does that mean for all of us? What does that mean for us as NFCB attendees and any sort of feedback on that? The second question that I have, which is kind of related, is the question of saving licenses that are being propelled onto the market from religious broadcasters. I think everybody in the room is 100% clear that we don't want at least many of the religious broadcasters, and I will take the point that the Unitarians and others are wonderful, and we have to be careful with that language. Mm-hmm. But that said, certainly there is a contingent of religious broadcasters that that we don't want to take over these stations. I guess my question is, since universities are publicly accountable entities, certainly it is more difficult for them to say that they are selling off an asset of the university to, shall we say, a very right-wing religious broadcaster than it is to sell it to a lovely-sounding public service network, which will continue the mission of the organization. For example, the University of San Francisco has a very strong social justice agenda. So my question to you very quickly is, what does it mean when public service broadcasters insert themselves into the process to prevent religious broadcasters, but in a sense end up facilitating those sales or making them certainly more public relations positive for the entities that are dumping these broadcasters? Would it be harder for them to make these sales if religious broadcasters were the only option?
Oh, okay. Is it this side? Okay. I'm Jennifer Waits, and I write for Radio Survivor, and I'm also a college radio DJ at KFJC. And I have a question. Classical Public Radio Network, who's attempting to purchase KUSF, has said that number one priority is to expand into the South Bay. That's where my station, KFJC, is, as well as a lot of other amazing long-time college radio stations. Mine's been on the air over 50 years. KZSU at Stanford has been on the air even longer, I think, and Santa Clara and San Jose State. So specifically, if this is about saving college radio, how can all of us in the South Bay who know we have targets on our back, how can we save our stations? And do you guys, and can you tell me who CPRN has tried to purchase in the South Bay? Because that hasn't come out publicly. Thanks.
Oh, hi. My name is Todd Urich, and I'm the technical director for a nonprofit called Common Frequency. And like PRC, we are actually a permittee of some channels, some radio channels, but we also help other applicants and nonprofits out there start community radio stations. And we've helped community broadcasters, student broadcasters, and even public broadcasters out. One thing about the deals at KTRU and KUSF that kind of bothered me is sorry, I just ran over here from the bathroom. Our group as a nonprofit, we act sort of as a liaison to making things happen between different groups and lawyers and engineers for the public interest. And when we heard of the KTRU deal, what we did was we went in to try to find a win-win solution for the students and the University of Houston that was the buyer. We found that there was Rice owned a 10-watt translator on the campus of Rice University. And we thought, well, maybe there could be a win-win solution here where the students were able to keep the translator and the deal was able to go through and that translator could be moved around to serve the core area there, the student population on FM. It could be fed with an HD2 channel, and I tried to contact several people within the deal there to try to impart that idea, but nobody was really open to that agreement. Both sides were just like, well, this is the way it is. This is the way the business transaction is occurring. With that, I'd just like to say that in many, many cases like this, and even with this case for USF, that there can be sometimes win-win solutions for keeping radio channels for the college that may be smaller, but, mere 1 to 4% of the transaction deal of maybe some money going back to the students or the community, working with engineers, lawyers, and even the FCC could find an alternative channel or some type of alternative option that student station could stay on the air. So that is one thing that I would like to put out there.
All right, Mary and Jim, and then Dorothy wanted to respond.
Hi, I'm Mary McDonald. I'm DJ Cousin Mary on KFJC in Los Altos Hills at Foothill College. My questions are about in an era where colleges don't have money, USC seems to have a lot of money. They're going to be paying, I guess if they get another station in the South Bay, at least $10 million just for radio frequencies in the non-commercial space. So I just would like to know where they got that money and how they, what they think they're getting for that money. Maybe they're a good example of how we can keep other college stations going. And so that's my question. Why is USC interested in spending all this money, and where did they get it? My other question is, do you think the FCC has the interests of college radio at heart? Do you think they support college radio in the non-commercial space? And that's it. Thank you.
I'll be real brief because Todd basically covered my question about the 91.5 FM translator that seemingly was given away and is currently dark in Houston. Austin Airwaves was a vocal critic of the sale of Rice Radio. Does not the broker do a detailed inventory of the assets being sold? And how is it that when I called with my reporter hat on, the Rice University officials seemed to be unaware of 91.5, and that would have been the answer for keeping students on, maybe at a reduced level? How could that piece of inventory have been sold off for seemingly you, perhaps you could tell us better, nothing?
One is, I spend my life teaching students. I think they're great. But this is more than just students. It's a college community station. And when I was a student, I decided to actually not work at the student station, but actually work at the college educational station in Toronto. Why? I wanted a better education. I didn't think just working with students was actually going to give me the kind of education that I wanted in radio. So we actually want to save the college community station. Mm-hmm. We don't want an HD. I've already told the dean that, and they backed off the deal around that. I'm not sure that we even want a side frequency. That's one thing. The second thing is, in terms of the future of college community radio, what seems to be the kinds of protocols around the world, and I'm taking this from a group of very powerless women in Andhra Pradesh in India, mm-hmm. who said, not only do we want local content, we want to do our own programming, but we want to own and govern our station. So those women who are the poorest of the poor, the lowest caste, are already understand what we need to think about here. We don't want technocrats to come in and operate our station. What we want is a locally controlled station. So governance, ownership, content, and also relationship with the listeners. And for Common Frequency, who are fantastic, to help us in terms of developing appropriate technology that's suitable for all of our listeners.
Okay. I'm myself on the list. Dorothy actually got to much of what I wanted to, but I do just want to make a point again about whether or not we're just looking at market values or whether we're looking at some other kinds of values. I would ascribe to some other kinds of values beside what our campus bean counters get to or anybody else. That is part of what Dorothy was I think, addressing in terms of the women of Pradesh. But the other thing that the bean counters, I think I would like somebody to maybe speak to, is what do you get from a traditional classical music station that you don't get from a college radio station? And the thing I know in our community is you get a different demographic. You get a pretty wealthy demographic, a predominantly probably ethnically white is not ethnic, but if you forgave Dorothy's grammar, you'll forgive my inability to speak to that at the moment. But those are things that even if you were looking at a fund drive that had a big classical chunk and not 20th century so much, they have more disposable income and more inclination maybe to dispose it towards a station. That doesn't mean that the content is necessarily
preferable. It's certainly not getting to the kinds of cultural issues that have been raised here in terms of the richness of college and community radio. And the only other thing that I wanted to add is the insidiousness of this process is such that Merced, which is the newest University of California campus, has been told by their dean in the immediate wake of the KUSF announcements that they don't need a broadcast station, you know, that they can do all the new media stuff. They can be online. They can do all of the things that we're talking about being partnered with our stations, but that they don't really need to broadcast. So that's my comment, and anybody that wants to engage it is fine. Other people want to comment to respond to the other things, and I think, Dwayne, you may also want to comment. So.
Hey, go ahead. Yeah, I just wanted to respond to a couple of the questions and comments that people made. First of all, where does how do you save college radio? And specifically talking about KFJC, which is a station we really care about at WFMU. I know that you think that Foothills College has no intention of selling the license, and that may be the case right now. But everything could change overnight in the blink of an eye, and you really should set up a not-for-profit. And every college radio station should set up a not-for-profit. And I haven't quite wrapped my head around why so many student stations who are concerned about this, why they don't do it. But I've spoken to dozens of student stations about what's the first thing we can do to prevent ourselves from being sold off or auctioned off. And I say set up a not-for-profit, and yet not one has actually followed through and done it. I'd be happy to help you do it. It's really a simple process. Second, does the FCC support college radio? No. No, the FCC does not support college radio. In fact, they make no distinction whatsoever between public radio, non-commercial religious radio, community radio, and student radio. It's all NCE, non-commercial educational licenses. They put no value on format. They don't take it into consideration at all. Third, I like the idea of win-win solutions, but I agree with what some others have said, that HD radio is not in the equation for a win-win situation. According to Bridge Rating Service, 3% of American radio owners own an HD radio. 3%. And that's after a huge publicity blitz on behalf of Ubiquiti and the electronics industry. That's not leading up to the publicity blitz. That's after the big publicity blitz. So I don't think HD radio is a solution, nor do I think SCA's subcarriers are a solution, or CB radio, or shortwave radio. As far as where does USC's money come from, I am guessing, I do not know, I have not looked into this, but my guess is that they, along with a lot of other non-commercial group owners, licensees that own a handful, or sometimes more than a handful, sometimes dozens of non-commercial FM stations, it can be a very, very profitable, charitable model where they're taking in way, way more donations than they're spending. And my guess is that USC's, and this is purely a guess, pure speculation, that the money that they are spending is coming from the surplus that they run, from the donations coming into their classical public radio network. And and I just wanted to agree with the comment that somebody made about the PR benefit for a university station selling their license to PRC. I think that a lot of universities and colleges want to get the maximum amount of money, but they are not willing to sell the station to a Harold Camping and Family Radio and be tied into the rapture. Some are. Some are not. So I agree with the comment that, in a sense, you are facilitating, and therefore it's the Heisenberg principle. You're not a neutral observer. You're, like, right in there affecting the market value, affecting the transactions, and I think affecting the acceleration of this move to dump this rare species of radio, these student community radio stations, and then just turning them into the blandest of the bland NPR repeater stations. I mean, it's like your mission that we have to keep public radio stations out of the hands of religious broadcasters, you're making a value judgment. And some may agree and some may not agree, but you're saying that public radio is better than religious radio. So it's a pure opinion value judgment, and there's no value judgment being attached to community and student radio. And those are my favorite stations. Those have been my favorite stations the entire time I've been listening to radio for 35 years. So where you're making this incredible value judgment and building up this incredible technique, but there's no value whatsoever. It's like you're going into a forest and saying the redwoods are more important than the maples, and these evergreens, it's garbage. They've got to go.
Oh, hi, everyone. This is kind of a compound question. It kind of has two halves. The first is sort of a question about sort of the larger place that we're heading. I did a little bit of research, looked at some old documents about 10 years ago, things like the Station Research Group and some of the entities that, you know, helped to bring public radio capital into business in order to specifically address some concerns in the public radio, think tank, maybe, is the right word. So looking over some of that stuff, what I saw was some very specific language about growth strategies for public service radio to continue through the next century. And there was some very specific language there about basically getting one's hands on all of the other licenses in the non-commercial spectrum. My thought when I come to something like an NFCB that is a union of both what we call community broadcasters and public service broadcasters is that at least on the surface there has been some sense of kumbaya or solidarity or we are all operating the airwaves in the public interest in one way or the other, some of us with larger amounts of CPB funding than others. So the question that I have, and there's a second part to this, is what does it mean if, in fact, the primary growth strategy for public media is the evisceration of community media or any and all licenses that are not already in the hands of public media? What does that mean for all of us? What does that mean for us as NFCB attendees and any sort of feedback on that? The second question that I have, which is kind of related, is the question of saving licenses that are being propelled onto the market from religious broadcasters. I think everybody in the room is 100% clear that we don't want at least many of the religious broadcasters, and I will take the point that the Unitarians and others are wonderful, and we have to be careful with that language. Mm-hmm. But that said, certainly there is a contingent of religious broadcasters that that we don't want to take over these stations. I guess my question is, since universities are publicly accountable entities, certainly it is more difficult for them to say that they are selling off an asset of the university to, shall we say, a very right-wing religious broadcaster than it is to sell it to a lovely sounding public service network, which will continue the mission of the organization. For example, the University of San Francisco has a very strong social justice agenda. So my question to you very quickly is, what does it mean when public service broadcasters insert themselves into the process to prevent religious broadcasters, but in a sense end up facilitating those sales or making them certainly more public relations positive for the entities that are dumping these broadcasters? Would it be harder for them to make these sales if religious broadcasters were the only option?
Oh, okay. Is it this side? Okay. I'm Jennifer Waits, and I write for Radio Survivor, and I'm also a college radio DJ at KFJC. And I have a question. Classical Public Radio Network, who's attempting to purchase KUSF, has said that number one priority is to expand into the South Bay. That's where my station, KFJC, is, as well as a lot of other amazing long-time college radio stations. Mine's been on the air over 50 years. KZSU at Stanford has been on the air even longer, I think, and Santa Clara and San Jose State. So specifically, if this is about saving college radio, how can all of us in the South Bay who know we have targets on our back, how can we save our stations? And do you guys, and can you tell me who CPRN has tried to purchase in the South Bay? Because that hasn't come out publicly. Thanks.
Mic's on.
Oh, hi. My name is Todd Urich, and I'm the technical director for a nonprofit called Common Frequency. And like PRC, we are actually a permittee of some channels, some radio channels, but we also help other applicants and nonprofits out there start community radio stations. And we've helped community broadcasters, student broadcasters, and even public broadcasters out. One thing about the deals at KTRU and KUSF that kind of bothered me is sorry, I just ran over here from the bathroom. Our group as a nonprofit, we act sort of as a liaison to making things happen between different groups and lawyers and engineers for the public interest. And when we heard of the KTRU deal, what we did was we went in to try to find a win-win solution for the students and the University of Houston that was the buyer. We found that there was Rice owned a 10-watt translator on the campus of Rice University. And we thought, well, maybe there could be a win-win solution here where the students were able to keep the translator and the deal was able to go through, and that translator could be moved around to serve the core area there, the student population on FM. It could be fed with an HD2 channel. And I tried to contact several people within the deal there to try to impart that idea, but nobody was really open to that agreement. Both sides were just like, well, this is the way it is. This is the way the business transaction is occurring. And one thing, with that, I'd just like to say that in many, many cases like this, and even with this case for USF, that there can be sometimes win-win solutions for keeping radio channels for the college that may be smaller, but, mere 1 to 4% of the transaction deal of maybe some money going back to the students or the community, working with engineers, lawyers, and even the FCC could find an alternative channel or some type of alternative option that student station could stay on the air. So that is one thing that I would like to put out there.
All right, Mary and Jim, and then Dorothy wanted to respond.
Hi, I'm Mary McDonald. I'm DJ Cousin Mary on KFJC in Los Altos Hills at Foothill College. My questions are about in an era where colleges don't have money, USC seems to have a lot of money. They're going to be paying, I guess if they get another station in the South Bay, at least $10 million just for radio frequencies in the non-commercial space. So I just would like to know where they got that money and how they, what they think they're getting for that money. Maybe they're a good example of how we can keep other college stations going. And so that's my question. Why is USC interested in spending all this money, and where did they get it? My other question is, do you think the FCC has the interests of college radio at heart? Do you think they support college radio in the non-commercial space? And that's it. Thank you.
Jim, and then we'll come back.
I'll be real brief because Todd basically covered my question about the 91.5 FM translator that seemingly was given away and is currently dark in Houston. Austin Airwaves was a vocal critic of the sale of Rice Radio. Does not the broker do a detailed inventory of the assets being sold? And how is it that when I called with my reporter hat on, the Rice University officials seemed to be unaware of 91.5 and that would have been the answer for keeping students on maybe at a reduced level? How could that piece of inventory have been sold off for seemingly, perhaps you could tell us better, Nothing.
Okay, Dorothy.
Yeah, two things. One is, you know, I spend my life teaching students. I think they're great, but this is more than just students. It's a college community station. And when I was a student, I decided to actually not work at the student station, but actually work at the college educational station in Toronto. Why? I wanted a better education. I didn't think just working with students was actually going to give me the kind of education that I wanted in radio. So we actually want to save the college community station. Mm-hmm. We don't want an HD. I've already told the dean that, and they backed off the deal around that. I'm not sure that we even want a side frequency. That's one thing. The second thing is, in terms of the future of college community radio, what seems to be the kinds of protocols around the world, and I'm taking this from a group of very powerless women in Andhra Pradesh in India, mm-hmm. who said, not only do we want local content, we want to do our own programming, but we want to own and govern our station. So those women who are the poorest of the poor, the lowest caste, are already understand what we need to think about here. We don't want technocrats to come in and operate our station. What we want is a locally controlled station. So governance, ownership, content, and also relationship with the listeners. And for Common Frequency, who are fantastic, to help us in terms of developing appropriate technology that's suitable for all of our listeners. Okay.
I have myself on the list. Dorothy actually got to much of what I wanted to, but I do just want to make a point again about whether or not we're just looking at market values or whether we're looking at some other kinds of values. I would ascribe to some other kinds of values beside what our campus beam counters get to or anybody else. That is part of what Dorothy was I think, addressing in terms of the women of Pradesh. But the other thing that the beam counters, I think I would like somebody to maybe speak to, is what do you get from a traditional classical music station that you don't get from a college radio station? And the thing I know in our community is you get a different demographic. You get a pretty wealthy demographic, a predominantly probably ethnically white is not ethnic, but you know, if you forgave Dorothy's grammar, you'll forgive my inability to speak to that at the moment. But those are things that even if you were looking at a fund drive that had a classical, big classical chunk and not 20th century so much, they have more disposable income and more inclination maybe to dispose it towards a station. That doesn't mean that the content is necessarily preferable. It's certainly not getting to the kinds of cultural issues that have been raised here in terms of the richness of college and community radio. And the only other thing that I wanted to add is the insidiousness of this process is such that Merced, which is the newest University of California campus, has been told by their dean in the immediate wake of the KUSF announcements that they don't need a broadcast station, you know, that they can do all the new media stuff. They can be online. They can do all of the things that we're talking about being partnered with our stations, but that they don't really need to broadcast. So that's my comment, and anybody that wants to engage it is fine. Other people want to comment to respond to the other things, and I think, Dwayne, you may also want to comment. So.
Hey, go ahead. Yeah, I just wanted to respond to a couple of the questions and comments that people made. First of all, how do you save college radio? And specifically talking about KFJC, which is a station we really care about at WFMU, I know that you think that Foothills College has no intention of selling the license, and that may be the case right now, but everything could change overnight in the blink of an eye, and you really should set up a not-for-profit, and every college radio station should set up a not-for-profit. And I haven't quite wrapped my head around why so many student stations who are concerned about this, why they don't do it. But I've spoken to dozens of student stations about what's the first thing we can do to prevent ourselves from being sold off or auctioned off. And I say set up a not-for-profit, and yet not one has actually followed through and done it. I'd be happy to help you do it. It's really a simple process. Second, does the FCC support college radio? No. No, the FCC does not support college radio. In fact, they make no distinction whatsoever between public radio, non-commercial religious radio, community radio, and student radio. It's all NCE, non-commercial educational licenses. They put no value on format. They don't take it into consideration at all. Third, I like the idea of win-win solutions, but I agree with what some others have said, that HD radio is not in the equation for a win-win situation. According to Bridge Rating Service, 3% of American radio owners own an HD radio. 3%. And that's after a huge publicity blitz on behalf of Ubiquiti and the electronics industry. That's not leading up to the publicity blitz. That's after the big publicity blitz. So I don't think HD radio is a solution, nor do I think SCA's subcarriers are a solution, or CB radio, or shortwave radio. As far as where does USC's money come from, I am guessing, I do not know, I have not looked into this, but my guess is that they, along with a lot of other non-commercial group owners, licensees that own a handful, or sometimes more than a handful, sometimes dozens of non-commercial FM stations, it can be a very, very profitable charitable model where they're taking in way, way more donations than they're spending. And my guess is that USC's, and this is purely a guess, pure speculation, that the money that they are spending is coming from the surplus that they run, from the donations coming into their classical public radio network. And I just wanted to agree with the comment that somebody made about the PR benefit for a university station selling their license to PRC. I think that a lot of universities and colleges want to get the maximum amount of money, but they are not willing to sell the station to a Harold Camping and Family Radio and be tied into the rapture. Some are, some are not. So I agree with the comment that, in a sense, you are facilitating, and therefore it's the Heisenberg principle. You're not a neutral observer. You're like right in there, affecting the market value, affecting the transactions, and I think affecting the acceleration of this move to dump this rare species of radio, these student community radio stations. And then just turning them into the blandest of the bland NPR repeater stations. I mean, it's like your mission that we have to keep public radio stations out of the hands of religious broadcasters. You're making a value judgment. And some may agree and some may not agree, but you're saying that public radio is better than religious radio. So it's a pure opinion value judgment. And there's no value judgment being attached to community and student radio. Mm-hmm. And those are my favorite stations. Those have been my favorite stations the entire time I've been listening to radio for 35 years. So where you're making this incredible value judgment and building up this incredible technique, but there's no value whatsoever. It's like you're going into a forest and saying the redwoods are more important than the maples, and these evergreens, it's garbage. They've got to go.